This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Last year, the world watched in horror as nearly 5 million barrels of crude oil spilled into the Gulf of Mexico. The explosion of the Deepwater Horizon rig killed 11 people and sent the oil flowing. The BP oil company capped their spill last July, and the story passed from view. Wilmington writer David Gessner went down to the Gulf of Mexico during the spill to get a firsthand account. He has since written a book called The Tarball Chronicles, A Journey Beyond the Oiled Pelican into the Heart of the Gulf Oil Spill. It examines what happened in the Gulf when the cameras were turned off. David, welcome.
Thanks, Frank.
Good to have you on the program. I want to start with this image that you return to over and over in the book, the oiled pelican. What's the importance of that for you?
Well, for me, you know, the subtitle, as you pointed out, is Beyond the Oiled Pelican. And for me, the oiled pelican became kind of the cliche of the spill, the easy cliff notes to the spill. And I had a moment, you know, my working method is I'm not really a journalist. I'm kind of a throw yourself down there and see what happens kind of writer. And when I was down there, I talked to a construction worker in a bar in Mobile, Alabama. And he said to me, well, I hope that bird is living a good life somewhere. I hope it's in a cage and they're spoon feeding it because they sure trotted it out for every occasion this summer. And then he said, on the one hand, they overreported this thing at first. On the other hand, they underreported it later. The whole thing is other hands. And the whole time I was down there, I kept that in mind. The whole thing is other hands. I wanted to kind of capture that strange, ambivalent feeling down there.
Well, let's take a look at those other hands. Overreporting. What was the overreported part, or the wrongly reported part?
Well, you know, I don't know that it was overreported, but it was. It's hard to imagine back. It's a little bit like imagining back to right after September 11th. That first couple months, there was this feeling that we're going to have an Exxon Valdez experience from Texas to Florida. And, you know, I was talking to a lot of naturalists down there. We're going to have this gooping thick oil just killing everything everywhere. And with that in mind, the main photos beamed back were those of oiled birds. Understandably, it's an incredibly powerful image. But when that did not come to pass, you got to kind of experience our national media's attention deficit disorder. It was like, okay, we didn't have that. Time to move on to tsunamis and tea parties. Not thinking that there was kind of a deeper, subtler disaster that was still going on. And it really hinged on the fact that to not have that shoreline disaster, we also dumped millions of gallons of dispersant, Corexit, into the waters, and the oil sank to the ocean floor, which kind of was an out-of-sight, out-of-mind trick. I understand why they did it, and I actually feel ambivalent about that, too, because I think it's great we kept it from the shore, but it's still down there on the ocean bottom, and there are still things happening that are no longer reported that are the result of the spill.
Well, let's get to that then, the underreported. As you say, there's still lots of oil now on the bottom, and it's not staying there.
Well, yeah, I was down there about a month ago, and I was walking along the beach, Bon Secours in Alabama Beach, where I'd walked during the height of the spill. And I looked ahead of me, and through the mist, there were about 25 BP workers with nets and poles picking up tarballs. And along the beach, a fresh crop of tarballs was being kicked up by the waves after Tropical Storm Lee and then some thunderstorms. And the Talking Heads line, same as it ever was, came into mind. I went down 6 months after the, or 4 months after the spill, and a guy I relied on quite a lot during the spill, a guy named Ryan Lambert, who was a Cajun fisherman and hunter, took me out back behind his lodge and showed me 200 pounds of shrimp he just brought in. And he picked one up and he put it in front of my eye, and there was like a little ink splash over the gills, like a black, like the way India ink is when you drop it in water. And he said, look at that. And he said, I talked to the authorities and they told me it's black gill disease. Well, I've been down here hunting and fishing for 30 years, and I've never seen it before. And then he said, I've seen 5 or 6 fish kills this fall, and I'd seen one in my previous 30 years. And so to me, there was a frustration at that point, and this is only a few months after the capping, there was a deep frustration that this was no longer the hot story. I mean, at the height of the spill, CNN was devoting 44% of its coverage to the spill, and after the capping, and it was declared over, you know, it just dropped off the cliff in terms of coverage.
Well, and just take a look at the images. Without the oiled pelican, the ink blot the ink spot on the shrimp, you can't think of a smaller way to represent what could be a catastrophe.
Yeah. I should point out, you know, one of the things when I say it's all other hands, one of the things I wanted to, I wasn't going down there to kind of tear the lid off an environmental story. That happened somewhat incidentally. I really went down there as a creative writer, kind of throwing myself into a situation and experiencing all the aspects of it. And if the book works at all, it works because the reader will come along with me into this kind of strange through-the-looking-glass world of the Gulf during the spill.
Well, and one of the strange things we see is how much control BP had over the cleanup and how that accident was perceived all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, right from the beginning, having their crews on the beach, the very first place I stopped, in fact, off of Pensacola, the rangers at Fort Pickens said to me, "We feel like we're living in an occupied country." You know, I asked if I could go for a swim, being kind of an insane person. And they said, well, according to BP, if it looks clean, you can go in. So the rules on the ground were being set by BP. And now, you know, it was fine that they were being on the rig and in the Gulf far out. That made sense because they had expertise. But you would have thought the Coast Guard or a more national presence would be in charge on the beaches themselves. And for me, one of the really kind of stirring images was seeing these fishermen going out to clean up oil, and they were wearing life preservers, which they probably hadn't done since they were 3 years old. You know, they'd been going out on boats their whole lives, and they had to wear them for the safety reasons working for BP. It seemed a physical embodiment of a fact that another fact, and the fact was if you signed on to work for BP, you also signed away your right to criticize BP.
Well, and how was that perceived? Because, again, that's what you're looking at, not so much the what are the facts on the ground. You got some of those, but how people are perceiving what's happening to them. What were you hearing from the people down there?
Well, there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of, you know, one thing that was really interesting to me is the way it belies our red versus blue CNBC versus Fox Nation. I mean, Ryan Lambert's as conservative as they come, and we had a lot of overlap. You know, we both loved birds. As I say in the book, he loved shooting them, and I loved looking at them through binoculars, but we both knew their habitat. And so there was a lot of kind of grassroots anger. But it was, again, complicated. I was out on a fish camp for a night with a young guy, young Cajun guy, who it was like a little shack floating on the wetlands, and about a mile away the oil was coming in. And he went on this tirade against BP and against the oil. And then practically in the next breath, he went on a tirade about Obama saying, I hope they start letting us end this moratorium. Because he had parents in the oil business. So it's, you know, it was really, really complicated.
Complicated, too, because part of the narrative during the time was the potential and the reality of working people losing their living while all this is happening and for we don't know how much longer. But then part of your book talks about an island where some of the citizens were actually using the spill as an excuse to get the government to save their homes from erosion.
Well, I wrote in the book the only thing, you know, gushing more than oil down there was self-interest. And this island, Dauphin Island, they really had their kind of eye on the ball. And when this oil money suddenly came up in Alabama through the governor's office, they basically did what residents of North Carolina like to do, which is nourish the beach, as it's called euphemistically. They piled all this sand in front of their houses that were about to fall in the water. And they did this because they'd always wanted to do it and because it had been declared illegal. But now it was suddenly legal because oil money, oil emergency allowed it to be. So, in other words, they scored big, and they claimed they were protecting their beaches from the oil, which was ridiculous.
Well, I was going to say, is there anything in the protocols that suggests this will somehow protect the environment from oil?
No, there isn't. No. But, you know, it was a crazy mood of panic. You know, I had a friend, Bethany Kraft, who was the president of the Alabama Coastal Foundation. And she said she worked closely, and she said you could just see fear in people's eyes. If you remember that time, there were all these crazy suggestions. At one point, somebody said we should set off a nuclear bomb underneath the water. I mean, it was a time of panic.
The book is as much about a spill as about the race against the race against nature, humanity outpacing the natural environment. Tell us about that aspect of this book.
Well, I just can't, you know. It's something I've thought about a lot. And back when I lived on Cape Cod before I moved to Wilmington, I was friends with a guy named Bob Finch, and he had a book called A Place Apart. And it was an anthology of Cape Cod writing, nature writing. And I loved the book, but I don't like the phrase anymore, A Place Apart. I think we here in Wilmington are connected to my old home on Cape Cod, and we're connected to the Gulf. And the idea that the Gulf was this national sacrifice zone, that we could give up this place so that we could keep living the way we live and pumping gas into our cars, was something that really struck me while I was down there. The sense, you know, one thing that I did a lot down there is birdwatch. I remember looking at a roseate spoonbill that looked like a living pink bruise through my binoculars, and right behind me was Halliburton Road. I remember looking up at an osprey nest where the fledglings were going, chew, 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 as a truck backed up, beep, 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 to bring tar balls to the central site. So there was this constant juxtaposition of beautiful sights and industrial creepiness, basically. Yeah. And to me, I thought, this is what we're losing. This really is everywhere on all our home fronts. We're losing the natural world. And the scary thing is, when we lose it, there's no path back. This is something that's evolved for millions and millions of years. And you can't just suddenly recreate it once you've destroyed it. And there was a sense down there, not just that we were destroying this beautiful, spectacular place. I'd never been to the Gulf before. I was blown away by how beautiful it was. And in fact, it's quite a lot like coastal North Carolina. But not just that we're losing this beautiful place, but I felt like I was living inside the future, you know, a semi-Mad Max future where resources and nature and everything were right beside each other. And you had all these people who were losing this place that they loved so much, but also they needed this thing to survive and make money. So it was heartbreaking.
Afraid to change the way they're doing business because that's the way they do business.
Exactly. The book is called... And we're all like that. You know, we're all implicated in that.
Yeah.
We're all afraid to change the way we do business.
Because in part, you can talk about spills and the accidents, but there's another way that the oil economy contributes to coastal degradation, and that, of course, is climate change. And there's a point in the book where you're in New York City now, and you're imagining what that would look like if the sea level rose. So tell us more about that. And again, that's where we're all implicit, because I drove to work today.
Yeah, so, and I did too.
I made the oceans rise just a little bit more.
Yeah, and I say right in the beginning of the book, I drove down there. I went on the spur of the moment, and I was pumping the same thing into my car that was gushing in the Gulf. So I'm a hypocrite too.
Right.
I went up to New York City with Orrin Pilkey, who's your neighbor up there. Mm-hmm. You probably know of him.
He's been on the show many times.
Yep, and Orrin has talked about coastal development in North Carolina, and I traveled the coast here with him. But I decided to bring him up to New York City and ask him the simple question, what would happen with sea level rise, not even extreme sea level rise, let's say 6 to 9 inches, and a Category 3 hurricane? And then we walk through New York City, and then at that time, Ground Zero was still kind of a pit and a hole in the ground. It hadn't been built up. And we imagined that as a lake, since it's so close to Battery Park, and we imagined water flowing down the subways as kind of a waterfall. And then something really interesting that's probably for North Carolina residents, one of the problems on the Outer Banks, of course, is you have roads that run from the coast side through to the marsh side, and they become inlets when the storms come. Well, New York has something similar in its cross streets that run from river to river. And in that scenario of a Category 3, you'd have water running across then. They'd become rivers. And it was interesting because the book came out about 2 weeks after Irene, which essentially, you know, the Weather Channel was talking about a similar scenario. It didn't come to pass, but it's all – the book isn't just about the spill. It's about the state of our coasts and the state of uncertainty that anybody accepts when they live on the coast.
And it includes your meditations, your musings, and interviews with colorful characters like Ryan Lambert. Tell us about him.
Well, I knew Ryan. You know, I got down to southern Louisiana, and I noticed that a lot of the inns were full, and they were full of imported workers who'd come down to help with the cleanup. Now, I could go off on the cleanup. They lay down boom, which is like my daughter's floaty device. They lay down boom, and I watched oil just wash right over the boom. So I remembered from my childhood as a Celtics fan that Red Auerbach had talked about false hustle. you know, you pretend you're working hard, but you're not. And a lot of the cleanup, I think, was false hustle. But Ryan's lodge, the Cajun Adventures Fishing Lodge, was empty, unlike the other lodges. So I asked him about it, and he said, "I'm not going to whore out to BP." So instantly, my writerly mind said, "This guy I got to hang around with." And sure enough, he took me out on the marshes. He showed me things I wouldn't have known over the next few days. And then there was one other group in the lodge, the nearly empty lodge, and they didn't look like hunters or fishermen. They looked like ultimate frisbee players. And I walked over, and it turned out it was the Cousteau film team. And within a beer's worth of talking, they had invited me to go up in the helicopter out to the rig the next day. So they also became kind of an ally during the whole thing. They actually took me in to see actual oiled pelicans at the Fort Jackson Rehab Center. They had me pose as a key grip on their film team to get in.
Well, you even saw one unoiled pelican. I think we have about 30 seconds left for that story.
Yeah, we saw an oiled pelican out on the kind of the frontline barrier island. I thought it had been oiled. I found it, brought Ryan over, and Ryan lifted the bird up and pulled a catfish skeleton from inside the bird, kind of like a magician pulling out a sword. And Ryan said it bit off more than it could chew, which was his pithy autopsy on the bird. So it wasn't always oil that killed things. I mean, it was never obvious and never clear.
David Gessner, thanks so much.
Thank you, Frank.
David Gessner, an associate professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina in Wilmington. He is the author of The Tarball Chronicles. And for more information about him, go to davidgessner.com. That's the State of Things for today. Go to our website, stateofthings.org. You can follow us on Facebook as well. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.